It is Tuesday afternoon at 3:30 and time for the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. Surviving the Future, subtitled Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It's edited by Sean Chamberlain from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic. And we thank both Sean Chamberlain and Chelsea Green Publishing for allowing us to air the audiobook chapter by chapter, which we've been doing now for many weeks.
We have,
yeah.
Because there's many chapters, I guess.
There are many chapters, and it takes longer to the audio of each chapter seems
right.
to take longer than the chapter looks. Like 4 or 5 pages of
yeah.
of a book doesn't seem like that long.
But you know what's funny, too, is as we listen every week, I realize that when I read a book like this, I go back and, you know, read a sentence again or a paragraph again. And when I'm listening, I go, don't get that chance.
So right.
I have to really pay attention.
Yeah. And you can follow all the previous chapters have been archived at RadioKingston.org. So if you want to start over or listen at your leisure, you can do that. I read along with
yep.
a copy of the book to what we're listening to here. And did you have a count of how many times you've actually gone back to the book? And
no, but I had it by my bedside. I would call it my Bible. That's the thing I had by my bedside to get inspiration and relief.
Yeah. You know, I've read it through once and then mm-hmm. picked up different pieces of it. And hearing it in this format is such a wonderful experience. And yep. having gone through it all these weeks, I keep coming back to the same conclusion, which is, don't you want to live this way?
Exactly. I mean, I think that's why I was so inspired, because you read it and you just say, yes, this is an orientation I can get behind.
Yeah. And last chapter, chapter 10, was religion. And on that note of don't you just want to live that way, chapter 11 is called Utopia, but with a question mark.
Mm. All right.
So we'll take a listen to that now, and we'll chat afterwards.
Chapter 11, Utopia? Utopia is a place of ideal government, good judgment, and a perfectly cared-for ecology. It is an important idea because it is a way of thinking afresh, not only about what society ought to be, but what it will need to be. For it is argued that the world has become too dangerous for anything less than utopia. As the futurist William Kottke puts it, creating a utopian paradise, a new Garden of Eden, is our only hope. The idea that every community, every village, no matter how small, should have, in the middle of it, a building of the greatest beauty they can manage, reaching up into the sky, a place of wonder and reflection, a seedbed of common purpose, made from gifts of money and labour, coming to terms with the riddles of life and death, and bringing private lives and the setting up of families into the embrace of the community. Well, you might think it a ridiculous utopia if it had not happened. Yet utopias do not have to be realistic to be interesting. They lift the spirits. Here, William Morris is being driven gently in a carriage with the graceful and pleasant lines of a simple Wessex wagon and pulled by a strong grey horse through an area of rural forest called Kensington. It was exceedingly pleasant in the dappled shadow, for the day was growing as hot as need be, and the coolness and shade soothed my excited mind into a condition of dreamy pleasure, so that I felt as if I should like to go on forever through that balmy freshness. My companion seemed to share in my feelings, and let the horse go slower and slower as he sat inhaling the green forest scents, chief amongst which was the smell of the trodden bracken near the wayside. In the utopia of Morris's News from Nowhere, industry, slums and suburbs had all been swept away, leaving an idyll of villages, meadow and woodland. The much reduced population consisted of friendly, laughing people, given to festivals and handcrafts, and needing no laws. Anyone who did wrong would be quickly overcome with remorse. Even the weather was better. Oh, and the women were lightly clad and affectionate, enjoying nothing better than waiting on and cooking for the men. Shaped by personal fantasies, Utopia belongs to an ancient tradition. It was often lyrical, especially with the ancient Greeks. Once upon a time, wrote Hesiod, people lived free from sorrow, work, and the pain of old age. The harvest yielded abundantly of its own accord. Yes, and it was eternal spring, added Ovid, and yet luscious autumnal harvests presented themselves to be gathered. Golden honey dripped from the trees. And Edmund Spenser, too, made sure that in his Garden of Adonis, there is continual spring and harvest there. Continual. Both meeting at one time. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen, 1596. The people in this land of perfection, according to Pindar, delight themselves with horses, wrestling, music, and games of draughts, while all around them blooms the fair flower of perfect bliss. And from there, of course, there was plenty of scope for going seriously downhill. In the long, varied, and outrageous tradition of cocaine utopias, fish come to the house, bake themselves, and serve themselves on the tables. Parties of young monks come across groups of willing young nuns bathing in the river. This, we are assured, is better than paradise. More recently, utopias have tended to be rather more practical than this, and focused on the writer's favourite subject. There have been proposals for population control, for reproduction being taken over entirely by state baby factories, for a virtual prohibition of heterosexual sex, and a lyrical description of a depopulated landscape reverting to the wild wood after an apocalyptic population collapse. Other utopias propose the abolition of money, psychological conditioning, total surrender to the passions, the replacement of commerce by a state-controlled industrial army, a single global language, a literary education, the greening of Europe, subsistence farming and the simple life, a return to manual skills, and a happy, innocent land inhabited by the noble savage. After all that, it is reassuring to come across a prediction which actually came true, though a little short on excitement. In the Diothas in 1883, John McNye predicted the general use of the horseless carriage, capable of reaching 20 miles an hour, and the hero of this life in the fast lane deserves credit for accuracy. You see the white line running along the centre of the road, resumed Utis. The rule of the road requires that line to be kept on the left, except when passing a vehicle in front. Then the line may be crossed, provided the way on that side is clear. But take heart, for the pace picks up again with J.D. Bernal and Freeman Dyson's technology of immortality, with its self-replicating machines capable of infinite work, and the colonization of space by the forestation of giant asteroids, with trees growing hundreds of miles tall, amongst which the human species would find, once again, the wilderness and freedom that it lost on Earth. But then there are the darker utopias. The states which see themselves as delivering a wonderful future and are prepared to put up with pain and tyranny as the price of getting there. Tyranny's diet, a mixture of good intentions, fantasy, and terror, was there in the Soviet Union, the Third Reich, the People's Republic of China, Orwell's Oceania, and Huxley's Brave New World. It was there too in Tsarist Russia, and we get an eye and ear witness account of it from the observant French tourist of the 1840s, Astolphe de Custine. Its most impressive accomplishment, he tells us, was the silence. It was quite a peaceful place, in fact. Russia is a nation of mutes. Some magician has changed 60 million men into automatons who await the wand of another magician to be reborn and to live. Nothing is lacking in Russia, except liberty. That is to say, life. It is a mistake to try to build a heaven on earth. This is the millenarian fallacy, characteristic of those waves of populist belief about the complete transformation and redemption of society, often involving the second coming. You can recognize it from its limitless scope, the support it gets from a dislocated and rootless population, and the catastrophic realities that prompt it. The turbulent decline of the market economy could stir these ingredients into action. As Norman Cohn wrote in 1957, the old religious idiom has been replaced by a secular one. And this tends to obscure what otherwise would be obvious. For it is the simple truth that, stripped of their original supernatural sanction, revolutionary millenarianism and mystical anarchism are with us still. Utopia's Golden Age. Once, there was a time when utopia invention could be taken seriously. In the summer of 1509, the scholar and lawyer Sir Thomas More invited his friend Desiderius Erasmus to stay with him at his house in Chelsea while he recovered from a visit to Italy. They talked at length about what he had seen on his travels. The Pope at that time was the multitasking Julius II, who combined the careers of Pope and general. As Erasmus explained, he rode off to battle, followed by a retinue representing a range of skills and support services, which maybe you didn't know were needed on military campaigns. Whores, lawyers, cardinals, bankers, and spin doctors who could prove that plunging a sword into your brother's vitals was an act of supreme charity in accordance with Christian teaching. For Erasmus, the only thing to do about this was to laugh at it. And his Praise of Folly, 1511, is a carnival of irony and sarcasm, the portrait of a society of erotic aggression, held together by little more than a web of mutual flattery. The habit, common in all the courts of Europe, of never daring to tell the truth. The book was a bestseller. The Pope himself is said to have enjoyed it, but for More, it was a shock and a reason to think about a better way of doing things. By comparison with the lunatic brilliance of Rome, More's Utopia, 1516, comes as a relief. Here was the ideal state, calm and sensible, a haven of sanity and groundedness. The first thing to do, he tells us, is to make Utopia an island, decisively separate from continental Europe and with the guarantee of freedom to decide for itself. If God hadn't already provided for this island status, then the omission should be corrected as soon as possible by a massive feat of collective digging. Now there would be a chance of a society that made sense. And More's Utopia duly defends religious toleration and promotes lifelong education. Small towns are surrounded by the land from which they derive food and fuel. The houses have gardens, loved and cared for as sources of food and delight. There is a supply of clean water and proper drainage and sewage systems. And yet, there is another side to this utopia. It includes a bundle of ideas which suggest to us that even in this most benign paper utopia creator, there is a controller who likes things done in his way. No private property, all houses reallocated by lot every 10 years, and built to a uniform design, which would extend to town planning, dress, and permitted games. The inhabitants even get up and go to bed at the same time. They eat in public halls, and discussion of politics is punishable with death. It's disappointing, really. Why the retreat to teenage authoritarian fantasy? Well, you can see More and Erasmus's problem. An earnest prescription of how life might really be lived, if measured, advisory, and credible, would actually have been incredible. The storm of destruction in the Reformation to come, which included the sack of Rome by the Holy Roman Emperor's own army in 1527, was to be a shock as yet unmatched, perhaps until the greater storm to be expected at the end of the age of fossil fuels. The mockery and exaggeration in their books signalled that this was not the time for policy prescriptions. Better to tease and goad. We, the readers, must work out our utopias for ourselves. The responsibility lies with us to do the thinking. Sanity does not run towards us in the form of spectacular ideas. We have to go looking for it. It matures in the minds of citizens. This utopia demands presence. More was right. Utopia really did get people thinking, not least by giving a name to the literary form, and the century of turbulence in Europe that followed produced a library of utopian writing. Anton Doni's The Wise and Mad World in 1552 outlined the role and responsibilities of the state, Francesco Patrizzi's The Happy City in 1553 included an early exploration of the arguments in favour of eugenic breeding. By the early 17th century, utopian writers were getting the hang of this, with practical suggestions about sanitary arrangements, which at the time consisted of, well, almost no arrangements at all. Sewage, garbage and waste from abattoirs and fishmongers were piled in the streets, scavenged by the tossers, assisted by pigs, geese and rats. When the Catholic councillors were thrown out of the window of the Chancery Tower in Prague by an angry crowd of Protestant deputies on the 23rd of May 1618, their lives were saved by the piles of waste of various kinds heaped up against the walls of the building, 60 feet below. The consequences of these conditions for water supply and health were regrettable, and the solutions proposed by the utopians were exactly what was needed. Freshwater conduits, reservoirs, a regular program of flushing away sewage, garbage collection, gardens, orchards, fresh air. In The City of the Sun, 1602, Tommaso Campanella described a system of pumps, cisterns, and rainwater collection. Ludovico Zuccolo, among many others, insisted on water stewards and inspectors of public health. Robert Burton, in 1621's The Anatomy of Melancholy, recommended that the most polluting and smelliest trades, such as dyers, tanners, and abattoirs, along with the fire-using trades such as smiths, brewers, bakers, and metalworkers, should be out of town, and that every city should have its fire brigade. There were recommendations for personal hygiene and exercise, proposals for a healthy diet, for midwives, prenatal and neonatal care, care for old people, euthanasia for the terminally ill if suffering extreme pain, and arrangements for burial and cremation. The anonymous IDM argued in 1616 for the reform of medical training, ending the then unhelpful distinction between surgeons, apothecaries, and physicians. Other matters of vital concern for these down-to-earth utopians included education, especially in science, and vocational training to be included as part of the school curriculum. They deliberated on the legal structures of society, on property, the family, crime and punishment, including the option of community service as an alternative to prison. They recommended improvement in agricultural methods, economic policy, monetary policy, and social justice. It was all too much for Shakespeare's Gonzalo. He decided to design a utopia of his own. Gonzalo. In the Commonwealth I would, by contraries, execute all things, for no kind of traffic would I admit, no name of magistrate. Letters should not be known, riches, poverty, and use of service, none. Contract, succession, born, bound of land, tilth, vineyard, none. No use of metal, corn, or wine, or oil. No occupation, all men idle, all. And women too, but innocent and pure. No sovereignty, Sebastian, yet he would be king on it. Antonio, the latter end of his commonwealth forgets the beginning. Gonzalo, all things in common nature should produce without sweat or endeavour. Treason, felony, sword, pike, knife, gun, or need of any engine would I not have. But nature should bring forth, of its own kind, all foison, all abundance, to feed my innocent people. Sebastian, no marrying among his subjects? Antonio, none, man, all idle, whores and knaves. Gonzalo, I would with such perfection govern, sir, to excel the golden age. William Shakespeare, The Tempest, circa 1611. The Lean Utopia? The lean economy is set at a time when the potential for the extremes of disorder and tyranny is increasing. The default position, the failed state, extending to terror on a scale too large for a coherent response, is in prospect even in natures which at present are orderly. Whether it is with a view to preventing such an outcome or designing a livable sequel to it, we need to think now about what kind of economy, culture, and society might have the best prospects. Does that make the lean economy a utopia? Not quite. It is more interested in the feasible than in the ideal. It is about advocating diversity, not promoting the best. Its aim is reflection rather than persuasion. Local lean economies are unique expressions of particular places. And lean thinking says that the people who live there are best able to work out what to do, if given the chance. Utopia has a universalist, one-size-fits-all tendency. It also means, ambiguously, no place and good place. But the philosopher Northrop Frye suggests a way to interpret this. The question, where is utopia, is the same as the question, where is nowhere? And the only answer to that question is, here. And uchronia? No time? When is that? The only answer to that question is now.
That's chapter 11, Surviving the Future, Culture Carnival and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy, titled with a question mark, Utopia. Mm-hmm. It's amazing all the early examples of attempts at utopia sounded dystopian.
Yeah, so many did. And it's just so, I'm struck by, it was, you know, 16th, 17th, 18th century writings that got, you know, continually obsessed with this idea just as the opposite was happening, right? I don't think it's a surprise that we would be hearing these writings, which, you know, so many of us, including myself, are not familiar with from, you know, 1516, I guess, Moore's Utopia. But he talks about an island and why wouldn't that be the United States? I mean, or America, right? That I'm sure subconsciously that worked into what people thought and consciously on some level of what they were going to create here.
Indeed. And many of those religious refugees from Europe who came to, you know, North America, to the new lands, had this idea of creating some sort of utopian society that was self-contained and unaffected by the right. others around them.
Right. Or the city on the hill or however it was done. And, you know, I love this idea that a livable sequel is what utopia is, what surviving the future is really about. You know, it's that controlled descent idea. Like, how do we go from where we are to where we're inevitably going to be in terms of a species, but what does it look like? How do we govern ourselves and behave and all of that?
Yeah. And again, scale making an appearance in this chapter because, you know, what is utopia for someone or some peoples versus what is utopia for a small group of people who are aware of their surroundings, aware of their resources, aware of their place and the people who are there with them.
Right. And that is so fundamental to how we think about things at the foundation in terms of the people that are experiencing their lives in whatever state they happen to be in are the ones that know how to make their lives better. You know, it's not up to us, again, that's colonial consciousness. It's not up to us to come in and say, we know how to fix your problem. It's coming in and saying, you know how to fix your problem. Can we help you?
Right.
Simple.
Yeah. Also, some of the descriptions from 300, 400, 500 years ago about what a utopia might look like sound pretty good, some of them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where we're talking about rotating out of your, you know, rotating out of your place of dwelling every 10 years, right?
Right, yeah.
And no owner, you know, I know that people are going to freak out. No ownership of property. What?
Right.
That's what we're built on. But if we all knew that what we had was sort of temporal and it was just going to shift, take that stress right off the table, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when I wrote the op-ed so many years ago, 2013 now, I guess, a number of people suggested I read Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, which is another version of a utopian future. But that went on to inspire book clubs all over the country and actually a political party. And I forget what it was called, but Williams Jennings Bryan, I think, was what came out of that. And so, you know, this idea of what would it look like can turn into how do we do it? And that's, I think, what we're trying to do here.
And I think, too, mitigating what you think utopia really is. You know, early on in the chapter, the utopia of, you know, nymphs and fairies and boundless food and, you know, free love and all this other stuff, you know.
Right.
You know.
And when I was listening to that, I was thinking what I think we've been kind of fooled into thinking over the past century or decades or something is that convenience is utopia. So in other words, the fact that you can go to the grocery store and get strawberries in December, or you can, you turn on your water and it comes out, you know, or there's hot water on demand. I mean, those things sound simple, but if it was 150 years ago, that's utopia, right? And so I think our consciousness, our DNA, kind of what happens really, I guess, in our limbic system is reacting as if we're in utopia, and yet it's not that at all.
If I were to suggest what a utopia might look like to me, it would involve people with slack, with time in their life to have a life.
Right.
It wouldn't be people pressed to the very ends of their fiber to try and make ends meet, to put food on the table, to be so stressed about things in life as to not be fully human.
Right.
To not be fully.
Which is really what we're looking at. And I'm thinking when you're saying that of things like being able to raise your children as opposed to have someone else raise them because you're too busy making money to pay for the babysitter, to pay for the food, to pay for the... Yeah, exactly.
And to revel in what's around us, you know, to have the free time to sit and turn your face to the winter sun for a few minutes.
Or to
spend some time with your hands in dirt in a garden somewhere or whatever it is that allows you to be yourself, your actualized self. Because so many people are not that, and it leads to so many instances of stress and mental illness and physical illness. And so I think that's what it would be. It would be that there was a collaborative group of people who had that and over the centuries, really, but even in the past, you know, going just 50 years back to hippie communes that began with that idea. Well, it makes me wonder, why isn't that possible? What happens along that path?
Well, and I think some of it lies in something that he said in the very beginning about the tallest building. I can't quite remember the reference, but I do remember someone saying that you could tell what was important in a community by the tallest building. And it used to be the church. That was the first tallest building. Then it was the state house, so the nation state and the idea of that. And now it's the bank. You know, the bank is the tallest building. And so we have so misplaced. And I'm not saying any of those are the right ones, but look how it's shifted from one power structure essentially to the next as opposed to a distribution, so there aren't any tall buildings, essentially, and we're all on a level playing field.
So the idea of utopia, what it looks like, how to get there, is still out there. It's still an open question.
Yes, it is.
Has not been resolved all these centuries later. And perhaps we'll get to that in part three. We have just finished up chapter 11, and which ends part two. Part three is titled The Path From Here to There. And next week, we go into chapter 12, which is titled Growth.
I like it.
It's Peter Buffett. It's Jimmy Buff. It's Radio Kingston 1490 WKNY, Kingston, New York. Join us again next Tuesday for the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club.